Before we proceed with the Bowles matter, I want you to go back to an earlier case this morning for purposes of our record in the matter of Bricker, which was case number 63340. Mr. Andrews appeared on behalf of the appellant, and he is counsel in that case, or was counsel in that case, as a result of his voluntary participation in the pro bono program. And I know that one of our counselors here today, on the next case, is also here because of the pro bono case assignment. And the court, in its entirety, greatly appreciates the efforts of the attorneys who are willing to give of their time and their expertise in order to ensure access to justice for all parties. And so I wanted to make sure that Mr. Andrews knew that I appreciated his efforts as I do Ms. Doves here today. And with that, we will proceed with case number 63099, Bowles versus Ruan Transportation.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Kelly Dove, and I represent the appellant, Travis Bowles. In this matter, I'm going to endeavor to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'll keep an eye on my time. The appeals officer, followed by the district court, found that Mr. Bowles had refused to participate or refuse vocational rehabilitation by his download of some copyrighted material while he was in computer training. This decision that his inadvertent download of this material constituted a refusal of services was arbitrary and capricious and an incorrect interpretation of the plain and unambiguous statutory language. The relevant statutory provision provides that a beneficiary may not be paid benefits if the injured employee refuses counseling, training, or other vocational rehabilitation services offered by an employer. Mr. Bowles did not refuse services. He had been put into this computer training program. He had excellent attendance. He enjoyed the program. He scored excellent on his test scores. He participated regularly with minimal absences. And on one day, he, as instructed by the faculty at the program, was downloading various applications and software. One was called RipTiger, and realized that the RipTiger program had captured minute increments of video and deleted those the same day. Also on that same day, a faculty member went onto his computer, discovered the software, and that the video had been captured, and terminated him on that day with no warning, no follow-up, no attempt to talk to Mr. Bowles about what had occurred. They just terminated him from the program. And upon appeal, the appeals officer decided that Mr. Bowles' downloading of that material was tantamount to refusing vocational services. And that's just not a fair or reasonable interpretation of the plain statutory language.
Was Mr. Bowles given an opportunity before the hearing officer and the appeals officer to explain his conduct, that it was inadvertent and that he wanted to participate?
He was, Your Honor, except that the appeals officer and the hearing officer wholly discounted his testimony because of his criminal conviction, which in itself was another source of error in this case. Opposing counsel provided two printouts from a local news channel blog that indicated that Mr. Bowles had been arrested and convicted of lewdness with a minor, and argued that this conviction, the court must consider the conviction in attacking the credibility of the witness. However, that misstates a number of aspects of this standard. NRS 50.095, which allows, it may admit evidence of a prior criminal conviction when attacking the credibility of a witness, first requires that you provide a certified copy of the conviction. That did not occur here. All that was provided was two printouts from a news blog.
Although those are hearsay, are they permitted?
Absolutely.
Are they admitted in the, are they permissible in the proceedings with the workers' comp and all?
before the appeals officer. Do their rules allow that?
I'm not aware of any rules that provide that the hearsay in a newspaper, which is considered classic inadmissible hearsay if you're admitting a news article for the truth of the contents, not for the fact of publication, for instance, that is classic inadmissible hearsay. It's also more prejudicial than probative because it contains statements that are unverified. It contains statements beyond the fact of conviction. So even if the fact of conviction could be admitted, the details are not supposed to come in. And then adding another layer to that error, this court has found for many years that there is no legitimate inference of truthfulness that can be drawn from convictions related to assault or battery. I mean, his conviction had, while reprehensible, certainly had nothing to do with truthfulness. So the fact that counsel argued, Your Honor, you must consider this conviction in analyzing Mr. Bowles' credibility, and then the appeals officer in her own order said that she must consider the conviction when evaluating Mr. Bowles' credibility, and essentially decided she wasn't going to consider anything he said because of this conviction. That's what's clear from her order. He has a conviction, therefore I cannot find him credible, despite the fact that there was no certified judgment. There was no conviction of a truth-related crime.
Wouldn't counsel have, or even the appeals officer, hearing officer, have a right to ask Mr. Bowles or any claimant that, have you been convicted of a felony, and if so, what is it? Can't you do that like you can in court? Yeah.
You can, except that when you infer, when you draw an inference about that person's credibility, when the felony conviction has to do with assault or battery, and not fraud or some other crime related to truthfulness, this court has found that there is no legitimate inference from saying, oh, you've been convicted of battery many times, or you've been convicted of assault many times, and therefore I can't find you credible. That's not an inference that supports.
Yeah, Ms. Dunn, correct. You know, it's been a while since I was in district court, but my recollection was that if a witness testifies, you can ask anybody, have you been convicted of a felony? And if the answer is yes, what is it for? And then it stops at that stage. Is that how it still works?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I'm just taking it to the further step, which is if the answer is I've been convicted of assault, where the fact finder is a judge or hearing officer, that inference should not be this person was convicted of assault, and therefore I cannot find anything they say credible. The other piece of that is she did not take into account Mr. Bowles' testimony essentially at all because of that. And strikingly, his testimony really didn't conflict with the letters, for the most part, that were provided by the respondent. I mean, the letters said Mr. Bowles used the Riptiger program. He ended up downloading some video clips that weren't permitted to be downloaded. Now, whether he had permission or was doing these activities as instructed by the faculty is not clear from the record, but Mr. Bowles testified, yes, I downloaded Riptiger. He was in computer training. I mean, he wasn't at a position where he was employed as a computer professional. He was being trained in a vocational program so that he could one day get a job as a Microsoft certified expert. So he was being trained to download programs, trained to get to know the networks. He claimed he admitted downloading Riptiger. He admitted inadvertently capturing some short video clips. And once he discovered it, he deleted it. Nothing in the letters or the evidence provided by respondents contradicts any of that. So to the extent the appeals officer said, I'm not going to find him credible, there was really no contradictory evidence between the two where she's going to say, okay, Mr. Bowles said this, and the letters say that, and I'm going to find that I believe what the written evidence is in the letters. Because for 98% of it, it's consistent. Mr. Bowles' testimony does not contradict what's in those letters, except for his denial of any willful violation of any copyright law. We also pointed out below and in our appellate briefing that this admitting of his conviction, or not just the conviction, rather, but these newspaper articles, that the prejudice far outweighed the probative value. you know, Mr. Bowles' crimes are certainly inflammatory, and by admitting these newspaper, or rather news blog articles, really tainted Mr. Bowles' ability to have a fair hearing on the issue, which was, did he refuse vocational services? And again, he had no warnings. There was no stated policy that he violated. I mean, certainly one needn't have a policy that says you must follow copyright law, except that he was in a training program where he was learning to navigate computer networks, and that he inadvertently downloaded copyrighted material occasionally, or inadvertently rather, does not evidence willful hacking or willful copyright violations, such that a single transgression with no warning and no coaching should result in his stopping the program with no notice. And finally, on the just issue of the probative value of his conviction, he never was seeking benefits beyond the date of his incarceration. So he admitted, I'm not entitled to benefits as of the date of my incarceration. So the conviction was not needed to show now he's incarcerated. That was never debated. He never asked for benefits beyond that date. And it really had no value other than to prejudice the case against Mr. Bowles. And if the court has no questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Davis.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lee Davis, and I represent the respondents. With respect to this appeal, I think it's important to note this is a workers' compensation case. And as such, the case evolves differently than what some of the other cases you might hear today. An injured worker or a claimant will request benefits, and those benefits will either be granted or denied by a determination letter, which gets appealed. Now, I've heard the hearing officer, appeals officer, kind of argued as one person, and I think it's important to make the distinction that the first level of the appeal process is before the hearing officer. Claimant has the hearing. That decision can be appealed to the next level, the appeals officer. The argument's made that, well, it's not important about his conviction. It is important because at the time that his benefits were first denied, he was not incarcerated at that point. It was only during the time that we were litigating the matter that he had his trial and he was put in prison as a result of his crime. Okay, so it is...
Mr. Davis, let me get the timeline. When was his conviction in conjunction to the processing of his claim here?
I think his conviction came about shortly before we had the appeals officer here.
So it was after the hearing officer phase, but before the appeal. Exactly. Can you submit new evidence at an appeals officer proceeding?
It's a trial de novo.
Okay.
The decision stands, but can be appealed, and we have a whole new evidentiary hearing.
So you was Mr. Bowles asked if he had been convicted of a felony at that appeals hearing?
He actually admitted to that.
He brought it up himself?
He didn't bring it up. I brought it up, and on examination, I don't remember if it was cross or direct, he said, yes, I am incarcerated, and my conviction is more than 1 year, and I anticipate that I will be getting out soon on appeal.
Okay. So the newspaper articles, though, is it your position they're harmless and that he already admitted he was a convicted felon?
That's correct, Your Honor. And because this was an administrative hearing, the statute, which talks about what the legal standard is NRS 616C360, which refers us to NRS 233B.123, which is a lax standard. And in that statute, it talks about that, basically it talks about if it's irrelevant, immaterial, or unduly repetitious, then the evidence doesn't come in. And they use the statute says that if this is a type of evidence that commonly would be relied upon by reasonable and prudent persons in the conduct of their affairs, it comes in. And then there is a section that talks about it has to be substantially prejudiced to a party for it not to come in.
So you're saying hearsay is not a proper objection?
Hearsay in these administrative hearings is not, no.
I want to just go one step further with that question or that line of questioning. Even if we were to assume that the articles could be admitted, my concern here is not necessarily about the admission, but about the content of those articles as being, he admitted he's convicted of a felony, and as counsel points out, it's an ugly conviction, to say the least. But the articles have details in them that I think are highly prejudicial to, frankly, any assessment of credibility. Now, you can't deny that one of the things that the appeals officer is going to be doing is assessing his credibility. Can you agree with that?
I agree with that.
And that's my concern. Can you address that? Is that they went too far, too much and too far?
Well, you know, and I think if you look at the actual decision of the appeals officer did look at and consider that he had that conviction. And does cite to the statute that talks about if you have a conviction for more than 1 year, this could impeach your testimony. But she also looked at his credibility by comparing it to the evidence, the documentary evidence. And what we hear is, well, it's not a lot there. You have two letters and an email, and you didn't bring any witnesses. And so it's his word against theirs, and since he testified, he should win. Well, first of all, there's a statute that says that if they want to subpoena a witness, they can do that. They didn't do that. But moreover, if you look at the evidence or the decision, the decision says, additionally, the claimant's testimony is contrary to the credible, persuasive, and substantial evidence provided by the employer and the insurer, namely the statements from New Horizon, that's the school, we had a statement, the email from the supervisor, and also two letters from the owner showing that the claimant had violated copyright laws, and that was the reason to remove the claimant from his vocational school program. So she looked at his testimony, considered his testimony, and compared it to the documentary evidence in this case, and said that his testimony is contrary. And she can't rely on his testimony because it is contrary, and she finds the documentary evidence provided by the employer and the insurer in this case was persuasive and substantial evidence. That gets me to my argument that really what we're here for today is that they're asking that this court reweigh the evidence and find that that evidence is not enough to support the finding that he was properly terminated from his vocational rehabilitation program. If you look at his testimony in this case, he says that he didn't know that what he was doing was wrong until he brought up this program and found out that, oh, here's a warning. We have the email statement from the supervisor that talks about that once you pull up that program, you immediately have the warning. So this isn't something that you download a program or you hack a program, and then as you're doing it later on, you find out that this is a copyright violation. You will see that immediately when you download that program. Also, his testimony was that, well, the school actually instructed me to do this and instructed me to teach other people, and it was common for us to download these programs, violating copyright laws, keep that in mind, but download those programs into the school computers and the students' personal computers. The appeals officer heard that testimony, considered it, and then when she compared it to the statements from the school saying, we don't do this, this is a violation of copyright law, she gave more weight to the evidence from the school itself.
I'm trying to figure out what Mr. Bowles would have to gain by downloading this copyright material. I almost thought that if it was done inadvertently, it seemed to make more sense than if it was than downloading it and then deleting it. So, did that ever come up in the hearing? Or
No.
Why would somebody do it? I just don't quite get it.
I mean, I would just assume that he's downloading the programs to use on his personal computers and taking them away from the school.
Okay.
But you're asking somebody.
Yeah, I didn't know. Obviously, you can't speculate. I just didn't know if it was part of the record here in the
I have problems with my cell phone.
Yeah,
okay. So I'm not really a technical person. Okay, so with respect to whether or not there was substantial evidence, I would argue that there was, and that we have all this case law from this court that says that we can't reweigh the evidence at this point. We have to rely on the findings of the appeals officer. With respect to the legal error, the first thing that I wanted to bring up is in the brief from Mr. Bowles. They talk about that we have a liberal and we have a broadly construed interpretation of the law for injured workers and workers' compensation cases. And they cite to the Nevada Insurance Commission v. Peck, a 1984 case. Well, we have a statute now in our 616A.010, which changed the law in the mid-90s to we decide the cases on the merits, and we no longer had the liberal construction interpretation of the facts and the law. The second thing that I was going to bring up, which I've already brought up, is that the standard for evidence in a workers' compensation case is not as strict as it would be in a civil case or a criminal case. And the cases that are cited in the brief talking about prejudicial effect, they seem to all be dealing with criminal cases. I would submit to you that here we're talking, according to the evidence, it looks like Mr. Bowles was cut off his vocational rehabilitation program 5 months before it was going to end. And so I would argue that you have to consider that when we're looking at the prejudicial effect. But as brought up earlier, I don't believe there is prejudicial effect because he admitted to the fact that he does have this conviction and that the appeals officer considered other evidence, not just the conviction, and left it there, but she went on and she considered other evidence. With respect to the argument that 616C.590 doesn't apply here, is assuming that Mr. Bowles would not have any consequences for his actions for violating his vocational schooling. If we have in the evidence the vocational rehabilitation agreement that Mr. Bowles signed on March 15, 2010, and under number 6, which he agreed to these conditions, it says maintenance benefits may be adjusted if lack of cooperation or noncompliance interferes with training, excessive absences may result in termination of rehabilitation services. Now, when an injured worker is in a vocational program, one of the things that the injured worker receives is maintenance benefits, which is lost wages. It's equivalent to lost wages. And he would be receiving checks every 2 weeks. By his signature of this agreement, he's acknowledging that he has to cooperate with the program. He has to be in compliance with the rules of that school and his program. In this case, we have the evidence that the appeals officer relied on and found that was persuasive and substantial evidence that Mr. Bowles was not being in compliance with those rules of the school. And we also have statutes that show in workers' comp the legislative intent where an injured worker is required to be in compliance in order to receive the benefits that that injured worker may be entitled to. NRS 616C.232 provides that an injured worker's temporary total disability benefits may be suspended or terminated if the injured worker is terminated from his employment for gross misconduct. We also have NRS 616C.140, which provides that an injured worker's compensation, the temporary total disability benefits, may be suspended, terminated, if an injured worker does not submit for a medical examination. So here we have legislative intent showing that we're telling the injured worker you're entitled to benefits, but you got to comply with the rules. You can't be in noncompliance with those rules. So when you're asked to do something, you know, we expect the injured worker to comply with those rules. The simple fact is Mr. Bowles agreed to these conditions. He signed the agreement. He has the agreement here. And the statute provides that if he does not, if he refuses vocational services, then he's not entitled to those benefits. The argument is, well, if you look at the language of the statute, it doesn't provide that if you are violating the rules of that voc rehab program, that your benefits should stop. I believe that if you read that statute, look at that statute, and keep in mind the legislative intent behind the other statutes, which require an injured worker to comply with the rules of the claim, if you would, then you would find that Mr. Bowles' noncompliance with this program is paramount. It is the same as if he is refusing those services. He's in the voc rehab school. He's got rules. He has to participate. If he doesn't want to participate using those rules, then that's the same as him refusing those services. And if there are no other questions, I'll submit it. Thank you.
One question, Mr. Davis, since you were at the hearing, when those newspaper articles were offered into evidence or the equivalent of that, did Mr. Bowles object to them?
His attorney did, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Ms. Duff.
Thank you, Your Honors. Preliminarily, I don't think that agreement that Mr. Bowles purportedly signed is anywhere discussed in the answering brief, though my quick thumb through while opposing counsel was speaking, I might have skipped over it. So that is something I believe is somewhat new, but I wouldn't swear to it unless I had more time to go over those materials. First, even if certain evidentiary standards are relaxed in workers' compensation proceedings regarding hearsay, that doesn't save the newspaper article issue here. And I think even calling them newspaper articles sort of elevates what we're talking about here since it's an online printout from a news blog. First, opposing counsel relied heavily on NRS 50.095 in offering that conviction. Not a workers' compensation statute, 50.095, which requires decisional law interpreting that statute requires a certified copy of the judgment. It's in the text of the statute itself, and this court's interpretation of that provision has specified even a minute order isn't sufficient, even an incomplete certified copy of the judgment is not sufficient. You must produce a certified copy of the judgment. So that is the statute that they've relied on all along in supporting the conviction. So just because some hearsay rules are relaxed doesn't mean the newspaper articles can take the place of a certified copy of the judgment. On top of that, the standard for even the relaxed rule was that it would have to be a source a reasonable person would rely on. And the appearance, even the appearance of these newspaper or news blog printouts don't inspire confidence in what a reasonable person would rely on as evidence in any kind of legal proceeding. It has a very tabloid appearance with a sensational heading.
Mr. Let me ask you this. I mean, I understand your point on all that, but if Mr. Bowles admitted the felony conviction himself in his testimony, does it really matter that much?
Well, I think those news printouts contain some damning statements that are attributed to Mr. Bowles that we have no idea are accurate or not. And in fact, his appearance at the hearing, at the appeals officer proceeding, was from prison. He was participating from phone while he was incarcerated. So again, offering the details of his conviction or this superfluous information that goes above and beyond the fact of his conviction, which has been admitted, he never denied the conviction, but then providing this evidence where statements attributed to him, as Justice Seda accurately pointed out, it's an ugly conviction, and to provide further details that are unsubstantiated. It's just highly prejudicial and adds nothing, especially in light of the fact that he's admitted he's a felon and he's, in fact, calling from prison.
So you're saying the details are prohibited. Even you can't even ask somebody about the details, let alone put it in the newspaper. That's your position.
That's correct.
So my concern is, assuming we agree with that, is it prejudicial enough to justify reversal in this case?
I think it is, Your Honor, because I think it's clear that the appeals officer completely discounted Mr. Bowles' testimony. And this kind of crime, I mean, he's not a sympathetic figure at this point once he has this conviction.
But your opposing counsel gave us a number of other reasons perhaps the appeals officer relied upon in discounting Mr. Bowles' testimony. What's your thoughts on that?
Just that the evidence is extremely thin. As opposing counsel mentioned, there's two letters and an email. The email is about five lines long and says, I found some copyrighted material on Mr. Bowles' computer. I'm going to suspend him. And by that point, though it's not at all clear from how in the record, that supervisor, that faculty member, had learned of Mr. Bowles' arrest. And Mr. Bowles testified that he felt targeted at that point. And that is one point where his testimony differs from the position of the respondents. But that aside, I mean, he thinks that Mr. Tingley went on his computer hoping to find incriminating evidence of something so he could terminate him from the program for the fact of his conviction, not based on his actual alleged misconduct at the facility. The other, and if I could just finish my sentence, the other letters, which just rely on the report from Mr. Tingley, say he's downloaded copyright material, we're terminating him. And again, Mr. Bowles admitted downloading copyright material, just that it was inadvertent, so there's really minimal conflict to decide between. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Dove. Thank you, Mr. Davis. This matter will stand submitted. And again, official thank yous on behalf of the entire court for your participation in our program. The court will be in recess until the call of the court.